Now to the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Bible, the fifth book of Moses, chapter 1 and verse 1. And I'll just read a phrase from the verse, "These be the words which Moses spake unto all Israel." And I'd like to begin a not too long series of studies on this remarkable and wonderful book of Moses. Well, the title that I've given it is The Last Sermons of Moses. And the words of Moses in this book are presented as sermons. Oh, to have before us the sermons of Moses, the man of God. To have them just as he declared them, as he preached them. Now, Deuteronomy as a book is not so often looked at in this way nowadays. It tends to be regarded as a covenant, as a constitution for the children of Israel. And to some degree it is. But all the old writers all see Deuteronomy as a homiletical book, a book of messages, a book of sermons, a book of application of the law of God, preached straight from the heart of Moses. He's soon to be taken to glory. He's at the end of his life and ministry. He's 120 years of age. He has led the children of Israel into the wilderness and their wanderings for 40 years. And now that second generation is about to enter the land which was promised to Israel. And Moses preaches to them. Now the title of the book, Deuteronomy, is taken from a phrase within the book, and it means simply the second law, or the law repeated. It's not the original title of the book. The Hebrew title in the Hebrew Bible is the very first words of the book, "These be the words." That's how books were titled in those days. You might think it rather unimaginative, but they were distinguished by the opening words of the book. And so is this. But the Latin Vulgate and the English translations that followed that really adopt their term, which means second law, or a repetition of the law. And that's characteristic of the book. It does present a reiteration of the covenant at Sinai, of the law of God, but it actually goes much further. It gives an evangelical interpretation of the law. It speaks of conversion. The Apostle Paul in the letter to the Romans says that Moses is preaching grace in this book, especially the magnificent 29th chapter, where Moses appears to give them a new covenant, different from the one at Sinai. Actually, in many ways, it's very similar, but it's got new terms in it, new descriptions, and it's called often the evangelical covenant. And what's the significance of it? Is it prophetic? Is it pointing to the new covenant of New Testament times? Many think so. And I think that is so without a doubt, because Moses is a prophet, not just a leader, not just a lawgiver, not just the man who God used to bring the children of Israel out and to organize and establish them and deliver God's law to them and deliver them that temporary covenant which held them until the coming of Christ. But, you see, perhaps if I can put it this way, during the 19th century, the cynical critics of the Bible, liberal theologians, began to redate Deuteronomy. "Oh, it doesn't go back to the time of Moses," they said. "It goes back only to the 7th century before Christ. The book probably discovered in the time of King Josiah. It's quite a recent thing." And that became a popular view among liberal critics. So, of course, there's no good reason for that view. It's only speculation. So evangelical minds were very heartened when from about 50 years ago, A lot of discoveries emerged showing the kind of treaties that were made up to and at about the time of Moses between landowners, big landowners, kings and regional warlords and lords of estates with their tenants, their tenant farmers and people who depended upon them. And these were called vassal treaties, and they had a certain legal order which they invariably followed. All this knowledge came within the last 50 years. And then it became rather obvious that in many ways this book of Deuteronomy follows the same style and order as one of these ancient treaties. And of course, evangelical scholars loved that because it gave them something very tangible with which to oppose the liberal critics and to point out this really dates the book where the Bible places it. It shares the typical legal literature of those days, and so it does. But the evangelical writers went much too far with this, and it ruins many of the modern commentaries. They've come to the point where all they do is dissect this book of Deuteronomy and divide it up to make it answer to and relate to an ancient legal treaty or covenant or constitution document. And they get carried away spending so much time with that, they no longer look at the contents of the book. So you get a very technical literary analysis of the book with just a few useful comments thrown in. And that's such a pity. So the old writers do much better with Deuteronomy. They see it basically as sermons. Who's right? Well, both are right to some extent. It is the last sermons of Moses, the man of God. Great sermons to the heart. Sermons of theology and practice and exhortations and expositions of the law of God. It's undoubtedly that, but it does undoubtedly follow, to some extent, the order of these kind of legal treaty documents of the period. And that's very interesting. But it goes much further. It's much, much longer than any of those documents. It's filled with non-legal language which would not appear in those documents. And it's quite clearly presented in the book itself as sermons of Moses. Speeches, statements, discourses of Moses. So I'm sorry to spend so much time with this, but that's the way I want us to look at it, noting that it does have remarkable parallels with the legal literature of the day in its format. Nevertheless, it's far greater and longer than any of them, and it is the sermons of Moses. So let's look at it from the very first chapter this evening in the time we have available. These be the words which Moses spake unto all Israel on this side Jordan in the wilderness. That phrase, this side Jordan, often refers to the West Bank, but here in the context it's clearly the East Bank, the east side of Jordan, in the wilderness, in the plain, and it is located there very precisely. Not only is it located geographically where these speeches were made, but when they were made. And you read on to verse 3, you find it was in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month. Why is there such precision? Well, these last sermons are so important. They're authenticated. Where they were given, when they were given, and there's more detail in the subsequent verses. And so we know precisely when they were delivered. Moses is 120 years of age, as I've said. Moses, mentioned 79 times in the New Testament, many times by the Lord Jesus Christ. Here he's approaching his death. He gave these messages, we would say, January to February of the last year before the Jews went into the Promised Land. 1405, though some say 1406, we can be more certain about the months than the precise year. BC, that is. But look at these terms in verse 3. It came to pass at a certain time that Moses spake unto the children of Israel according unto all that the Lord had given him in commandments unto them. This is inspired material. Both the law, when he reiterates it, and his exhortations are all inspired. And they do not only apply to Old Testament people, because although all the case laws, in addition to the moral law, only the moral law stands, the case laws are done away with in Christ and for the gospel age, yet at the same time, the principles are for all time. These are sermons to our hearts. Look at verse 4. After he had slain Zion, the king of the Amorites, which dwelt in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan. Here in verse 4, you're reading about things that happened in the 40th year of the children of Israel being in the wilderness. These are battles which have been witnessed by all that present generation. And in verse 5, on this side Jordan, the east, in the context, in the land of Moab, began Moses to declare this law, saying, verse 6, the Lord our God spake unto us in Horeb. And there he's going back to the very beginning. He says these words just before the entry into the promised land, but he's going to rehearse some history, and in verse 6 he takes them back to 40 years after they'd been at Sinai for about a year. The Lord spake unto us in Horeb. Sinai is called Horeb in Deuteronomy, saying, ye have dwelt long enough in this mount. Turn you and take your journey. Verse 7. Go to the mount of the Amorites. Well, they're going to the mount of the Amorites that will take them into the promised land. And verse 7, the commission that is given to them, 40 years before the time this address is given, makes no mention of their being held up in the land all these years. What would happen? Their disobedience. You read from verse 7, you see the original commission in the very beginning of their time out of Egypt makes it clear that technically they could have gone straight in and possessed the land then. It was only their disobedience that caused the 40-year postponement. So the instruction is glorious. Verse 7, turn you, take your journey, go up to the mount of the Amorites and unto all the places nigh thereunto, in the plain, hills, vale, south, by the seaside, even all the way to the river Euphrates. Now they didn't have that land, that much land, until the time of King David and Solomon. And yet the promise was given to them, and the marching orders, soon after the Exodus, immediately after the Exodus, to go all the way and occupy it all. God would have given it to them, had they had faith in him and trusted him. That's the sense of verse 7. And then in verse 8, all is ready. Behold, I have set the land before you. Go in. God will see to it that they're able to occupy. Possess the land which the Lord swear unto your fathers, to the patriarchs. All the promises are in the book of Genesis, to give unto them and to their seed after them. So they could have gone, but the promises were not trusted. They didn't have faith in the Lord, in spite of the evidence of his power and the pledges of his goodness that he'd given to them. And immediately we can be applying this, because that's our problem. The promises of God are with us, to serve him, to live for him, to witness for him, and yet we don't wholly believe them and trust him. And so we fall behind. This is an abiding problem, even with dear children of God. Verse 9, and I spake unto you at that time, saying, I am not able to bear you myself alone. I didn't read this section in our scripture reading, but this happened even before the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. We're going right back to Exodus 18 here, when this happened. You remember it was the father-in-law of Moses. It was Jethro who was God's instrument for telling him that now he needed to order society. He needed to form a competent administration. He couldn't lead these people inspirationally by himself. And it was just what Moses needed to hear. There had to be judges, leaders, rulers. There had to be a proper civil administration. And it was God who was behind it. Jethro isn't mentioned in Deuteronomy. He was the agency for the initial proposal, but it was clearly God who had this in mind. Right from the very beginning, even before the giving of the law, a wonderful administration, far superior to anything that the nations around had. Something unique to the children of Israel was formulated in the mind of God and given to them, whereby they would have to look out people who were worthy, people who were non-covetous. Of course, if they were going to be judges, administrators of justice, as well as civil organizers, they wouldn't be people inclined to take bribes or to line their pockets. The qualifications are listed in Exodus chapter 18, and they're very beautiful. All the arrangements God had for these people were remarkable. And even before the giving of the law, there was an administration through the country, organizing down the oversight of society in a gentle way, even to fifties, let alone to thousands and tens of thousands. And that was all done. And Moses refers to it here. You remember what God did for you? We were only 10 minutes out of Egypt, and God oversaw a tremendous organization of society, which blended liberty, tremendous freedoms, and laws would in due course be given, which would prevent any state apparatus being formed, that would take away the liberty of individual families and individual people. And yet there were people to look after you, and to administer justice, and to settle disputes and feuds and trials and problems. And he refers to it because it's part of the evidence of God's great kindness to them as a nation. No other nation works like this, the organization given to Moses. Other nations, people ruled by the sword. People had to be bribed everywhere. There was tremendous inherent corruption. But God was so good to this people. They came out of Egypt, and they've been described often as little better than a brickyard rebel. And yet they had given to them the most beautiful system for equality and liberty and law and order and kindness and oversight. And so Moses naturally spends a number of verses referring to this. Verse 13 of Deuteronomy 1, "Take you wise men and understanding." And Exodus 18 gives us greater detail. The stipulation that they must not be covetous people, known among your tribes for good reputation and so on. And I will make them rulers over you. And so verse 15, "So I took the chief of your tribes." Of course, Moses didn't take the chief of your tribe, their tribes, when these people were appointed. They were ordinary citizens, but the selection was so well done, and there was the oversight of the Lord, that those were the people who in due time became the chiefs of the tribes. So that's the sense in which verse 15 is to be understood. I took those who are now the chief of your tribes, wise men and known, they earned their spurs, and made them heads over you, captains over thousands, over hundreds, over fifties, over tens, and officers among your tribe. Then the terms, how they must judge. And there was a court of appeal directly to Moses, the prophet, the man of God himself, in verse 17. And down to verse 18, "And I commanded you at that time all the things which ye should do." And by the way, in the Church of Jesus Christ today, we still have, or should have, government by consent, as it was in the days of the theocracy in ancient times. Now, there are those denominations that are so organised that there is not government by consent. But one of the great features of nonconformity, and something which is always insisted on among us, is that the people nominate and elect their elders and even their pastors. And that's most important, and it's reflected even in the time of the law in ancient times. Look down to verse 19. And when we departed from Horeb, we went through all that great and terrible wilderness. This is going back 40 years again, which ye saw by the way of the mountain of the Amorites, as the Lord our God commanded us. And we came to Kadesh Barnea, well, which was where they spent most of the time. There were wanderings, but the encampment at Kadesh was the place where the Israelites spent at least 38 years. And that 19, verse 19, states the theoretical ideal route, but it was never adhered to because of the disobedience of the children of Israel. Verse 20, and I said unto you, ye are come unto the mountain of the Amorites. You're here, and the land will be given to us. We're right here. Verse 21, behold, the Lord thy God hath set the land before thee. Go up and possess it, as the Lord God of thy fathers hath said unto thee. Fear not, neither be discouraged. But here's the first sign of the lack of faith and trust in the majority of the people. Verse 22, ye came near unto me, every one of you. There was this universal apprehension, and said, we will send men before us. You know what it was. We want to send spies. And they shall search us out the land and bring us word again by what way we must go up and into what cities we shall come. There is great apprehension about what lies before them. Go and possess the land was the command. But no, we want a survey carried out first. We are anxious people. And just a word of application before we dive on, and it is this. We have the promises of God to progress in holiness and in witness, both to individuals and to churches. There is so much to be done. You look at churches up and down the country, and so often there's nothing going on. There's no evangelistic preaching. There's no dedicated prayer meeting. There's no activity. There's no working church principle operating within the church. Yet we've got promises to cover us that if only we will move forward according to the biblical pattern with the preaching of the word and the witness to the community, we will be blessed. Some people do nothing at all. Others do things, but in their own way. And they bring in, as I'm always saying, the entertainment and the contemporary stuff and all these things, because they've got to give God some help and use things which necessitate the abandoning of separation from the world. Well, this is, we parallel things in ancient times. Look again at verse 22. Here are the people wanting a survey of the scene because of their anxiety. And verse 23, Moses records, the saying pleased me well. Well, if their desire for a survey reflected lack of trust, how could it please Moses well? Well, in this way, because Moses knew that when spies went out, they may come back with stories of the highly defended cities, and they may spot some of the giant tribes, the Anakim and so on, but at the same time, they will see such a fruitful place, such a rich land, they'll bring back the clusters of grapes and the other fruit and all kinds of things, and this will dispel the reservations of the people, and this will give them great encouragement. I think that's why it pleased Moses well. He felt that it might serve to encourage the people. and sweep away their anxieties. But you know from the earlier record in the book of Numbers, it didn't achieve that at all. The reverse happened. Yes, the spies said, it is a good land, it's a wonderful place, it's absolutely ideal. The survey reported well, but then it said there are difficulties. And 10 of those people on that commission of inquiry also lacked faith. And they came back with gloomy reports, and they discouraged the people. So that meant that the children of Israel refused to go. Verse 24, they turned and went up into the mountain and came unto the valley of Eshcol. Well, Numbers record tells us actually they searched the entire land of Canaan. Things are abridged a little bit here. Verse 25, and they took of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down unto us and brought us word again and said, it is a good land which the Lord our God doth give us. At this point, Moses doesn't remind you, them, of the discouraging reports. They knew all about that, of course. Verse 26, notwithstanding, ye would not go up. Now, this is interesting because, of course, most of the people to whom he is speaking are second generation. The rebellious generation has died out. 40 years has gone by. Everybody under 40 was born in the wilderness. So they hadn't been party, they'd been babies or unborn at the time when the children of Israel rebelled and refused to enter the promised land. But Moses nevertheless says, notwithstanding, ye would not go up. He speaks of them as being identified with their forebears. People over 40, well, between 40 and 60, I don't think there were many any older than that. They'd gone. They were the older generation. But people between 40 and 60, they'd been babies or infants or teenagers at the most at the time of the Exodus. So it's mainly the new generation that is addressed, and yet they're addressed as though they're one with their forebears. Verse 26, notwithstanding ye would not go up, but rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God. They were unwilling. It was rebellion. The land was populated by powerful people. It had impregnable cities. Oh, friends, this is treason, not just faithlessness. It's all in Numbers chapter 13. And we're guilty of treason if we have a lack of commitment. The Lord calls us all as believers to consecrated lives. We've proved him. We've seen his power. Our minds have been opened. Our hearts have been opened. We've been radically changed. We've had so much blessing from him. Churches have been blessed. Individuals have been blessed. So lack of willingness to live a consecrated life is treason. It's a terrible thing. Oh, dear friends, and yet there are so many Christians. They feather their nests, they worship, yes, but they do next to nothing. Oh, the refusal to live a consecrated life and to serve the Lord, and even worse, so many maintain their attachment to the world with the giant television screens and the constant rock and pop music and all the rest of it. No separation from the standards, the lifestyle, the values of the world. That's treason, friends. So these passages apply to us. Moses pleads with them. He's going to say in this passage, he's going to say, God did so much for you. And look, this was rebellion. You wouldn't put your faith in him. You wouldn't trust him. You wouldn't enter into the land, despite not only his promises, but all the things you'd witnessed and all the evidences that you'd had of his goodness. And verse 27, ye murmured in your tents. What a horrible verse this is. They spread discontent. They muttered one to another. The discontent would spread throughout the tribes. That's the idea of the phrase, ye murmured in your tents, and ye said, because the Lord hated us. They justified their cowardice. They were thinking like superstitious idolaters. Ah, we have a God who is just against us. And that's how the idolaters used to think. The gods are against us. They're angry creatures. And so we need to placate their anger. And we make all kinds of food offerings and money offerings to these lifeless gods, the effigies that we have made, to placate their anger. Because the heathen concept of God was basically angry gods who you needed to make peace with them and do something to please with them. And here you've got the Israelites thinking like this. God is fundamentally an angry God. And there's something we haven't done to please him. And so he's brought us out of Egypt to destroy us. What a curious thing and a terrible thing to articulate. Verse 27, because the Lord hated us, he hath brought us forth out of the land of Egypt in order, let's say, to deliver us unto the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. And they say in verse 28, where shall we go up? Somebody propose a way where we won't be met with devastation and antagonism. Our brethren, that refers to the spies, the commissioners who went to inspect the land, have discouraged our hearts, saying, the people is greater and taller than we. The cities are great and walled up to heaven. And moreover, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there. Now Moses appealed to them in vain. 40 years before, 38 years before, verse 29, then I said unto you, dread not, neither be afraid of them. The Lord your God which goeth before you, he shall fight for you. They'd known that. They'd known the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. According to all that he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. Well, many of this generation had been babies or even unborn at the time of the deliverance from Egypt. But it was written on the national memory. They'd grown up to the tremendous stories passed down by their parents. This wasn't just speculative history. These things were facts. The great power of the Lord over them and all that he had done. And they themselves had fed from the manna in the wilderness and the miraculously provided water supplies. And they too had experienced no wearing out of their clothes or their footwear. And apart from the justice of God, which was administered from time to time, no diseases, no illnesses. This was remarkable. Even this new generation had so much evidence. Verse 31, and in the wilderness, where thou hast seen how the Lord thy God bare thee, looked after you, supported you, carried you, as a man doth bear his son, his infant son is in mind, in all the way that ye went until ye came into this place. Yet in this thing ye did not believe the Lord your God. Same with us, dear friends. You give up your unnecessary earthly luxuries, excessive entertainment, excessive leisure, put yourself to the service of the Lord, live for him, separate from worldly things. The devil comes and says, well, life will be miserable for you. How can it be? You've received so much from the Lord. You trust him, your happiness and your fulfillment and your blessing and your witnessing even more evidence of his power and goodness and being an instrument in his hands. All these things will be yours. And Moses preaches this to us as well as to them. Verse 33, the God who went in the way before you to search you out a place to pitch your tents in fire by night, to show you by what way you should go, and in a cloud by day. But no, they were unable to be persuaded. And verse 34, the Lord heard the voice of your words, and was wroth, and sware, saying, and listen to how this could just apply to us, Surely there shall not one of these men of this evil generation see that good land which I swear to give unto your fathers. Well now, the threat as it applies to us does not mean that genuinely converted people will not go to heaven. But it does certainly mean this, that genuinely converted people who do not want to be consecrated wholly to the Lord and separate from the world and used of him and in his service will lose much of the promised blessing of the Christian life, and they will languish spiritually through many, many years. They may not be total backsliders, but they will miss the power and the glory and the usefulness and the blessing and the joy which Christ has for his people in this present life. Save Caleb in verse 36 and Joshua in verse 38 and Moses, who was the meekest man of all apart from the Lord Jesus Christ, here tells them of his own failure. Verse 37, and the Lord was angry with me for your sakes, which means that Moses, when he disobeyed the Lord, the second occasion when the rock at Horeb was to give forth water, the first one 40 years previously, then in the 40th year of their roaming in the wilderness or being at Kadesh, just before they entered the land, the great water shortage repeats itself, and Moses is commanded by the Lord to speak to the rock. But instead of speaking to the rock, he strikes it with his rod twice, and he is very angry with the people, and he rounds on them. Well, they may have deserved a good telling off, but that was not his commission. Moses did not precisely follow exactly the things that God had told him to do. And so in that he did not set a good example to the people. He decided to interpret God's words to him extremely freely, to say the least, and do something different from that which God had instructed, and bear himself differently. And so for that, he suffered the punishment of not being allowed in the promised land himself to see so much of the fruit of his labours. What a lesson there is for us in that. Even a person who's been used of God mightily, perhaps a shepherd in the church, perhaps a preacher, a Sunday school teacher, even somebody who's lived an exemplary life as far as we can and has been used of God, could depart in some important respect from the blueprint given by the Lord, from his precise instructions, and therefore suffer a chastisement, perhaps a heavy chastisement, as Moses did, and Moses mentions it. And this is happening wholesale today. We hope that pastors will stand the avalanche upon the churches of contemporary worship and worldly, godless things, and even people who've been blessed and used can come under the anger of God and lead the people astray and buckle to things they should have stood up against. And Moses should have stuck to the blueprint. There is a pattern, church, in the New Testament. There is a way of doing things. There is a pattern for worship, a pattern for evangelism. We're to stick to it, not imagine we can improve on it, not subvert it, not adapt it. And so we learn even from Moses, the man of God, for all his greatness and his blessedness. And in preaching his sermons, in the first discourse, he admits his own fault. And that's a lesson for us. And then I must come to conclusion, because our time is almost up. Look at verse 39. Moreover, your little ones. Well, he's speaking to the nation. The little ones are not little ones anymore. These are the people who are up to 40 years of age, including all the fighting men who will go in and possess the land. But they were the little ones and the first generation that refused to go into the land, that had no faith and was fearful. They justified themselves by the need to protect their little ones. So Moses is addressed the land, "Moreover, your little ones, which ye said should be a prey, and your children, which in that day had no knowledge between good and evil, they shall go in thither, and unto them will I give it, and they shall possess it." And then addressing that first generation, "As for you, turn you and take your journey into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea." And then what happened was quite astonishing, quite remarkable. Perhaps I ought to say, this murmuring against God. Of course, among Christians, you don't often get murmuring against God. The murmuring against God, or the expression of no faith, comes out in a different way. Pastorally, you do get some people who enter into a contention with God, but it's fairly rare for Christian people, even in a backslidden state, to articulate things against God, like the Israelites did. But we show our rebellion in different ways. It may be that we're out of sorts, and we want to conduct our own lives in our own way, and do what we want, and follow what we think. And so we will just ignore divine providence. If we get a tough time as a result, a hard time, we should just blame the people who give us a bad time, or our environment, or something else. We won't reason as believers ought to and say, well, under the providence of God, this trial, this tribulation is something that God has apportioned for me, permitted to me. It could just be a chastisement, and I must be very careful to examine my heart that I haven't done things for myself only. Or it may be some course of training which the Lord is subjecting me to. But these days, if people are rebellious against the Lord, they don't actually say things against him. They just dismiss providence and the things that happen to them as just the things that happen. There's nothing to be read. There's no message. God is not permitting this or that. We handle them in that way. Like, another thing I'm always mentioning, the new generation of guidance books, which all say there's no such thing as Christian guidance or knowing the will of God. As long as you're taking reasonably moral decisions, you do your own thing and you do what you want. Now that's really the spirit of the rebellious generation. We will not go up. We will not enter. We will not. But nowadays, Christians express it differently. Oh, I don't believe in this business that I must do the will of God and seek his will and commit my way to him in prayer and be available to him. I believe those preachers who now tell me there's a new way of living the Christian life. I can just do what I want, marry who I like, take whatever career pleases me, which I will find most enjoyable or provide for me best, and so I won't consider that I must pray and submit to God and consider what I ought to be doing and things like that and his plan and his will for me. So nowadays we're more sophisticated. When we rebel, we justify it. And we find some teacher who will tell us that's all right. That is a perfectly valid interpretation of a Christian lifestyle. And so such views and such books are available to us. Let me hurry on down to this 41st verse. This is quite remarkable. The children of Israel are not going to enter the land. This is 40 years before the time that Moses preached this sermon. "Then ye answered and said unto me, We have sinned against the Lord. We will go up and fight, according to all that the Lord our God commanded us. And when ye had girded on every man his weapons of war, ye were ready to go up into the hill, to enter well into Amorite country, and to fight." Well, that's extraordinary. Have they really repented? No, they've thought about it. Now back in the book of Numbers we read that they had even planned to get rid of Moses and appoint themselves another captain who would lead them back to Egypt. But I speculate that what had happened is they thought about this and they'd realized, we can't do that. We can't do that. We go back to Egypt, there'll be a certain number of us are judicially murdered by the Egyptians, and the rest put back into slavery. No, we can't do that. And we don't want to stay here. This is a miserable life, and to be in the wilderness. So we'll go. They thought about the foolish position they put themselves in, and their repentance, well, let's call it crocodile tears. It was self-pity, because God has no sympathy for them. But Moses, verse 42, relates to them the instructions of God, go not up, neither fight, for I am not among you. They have no warrant to go. Oh, I wish I had time. I could tell you so many things in church history where the people of God have done quite the wrong thing, and then they wanted to retrace their steps, but in some other way, and God was not with them. You think of the movement for higher criticism, the flowering of theological liberalism in the end of the 19th century, the criticism of the Bible, and evangelical people, Bible-believing people, suddenly, in the last 20, 25 years of the 19th century, suddenly buckled into this. Oh, we can adapt this. We can use this. We're not going to fight this. Some of our famous men have buckled in to biblical criticism, which really undermined inspiration entirely. And they didn't deal with it. And year past year, and the major denominations that were nearly all evangelical, the Baptists, the Congregationalists, the Methodists, of course the Anglicans, they were first to go down to it, buckled in to the movement for higher criticism. Guess what they did? Come 1910 and thereabouts, and World War I, and soon afterwards, suddenly evangelicals seemed to get a collective conscience about this. There'd been no discipline. The denominations were now getting heavily polluted with cynicism and theological liberalism. The colleges were full of it and all this type of thing. What will we do? Let's evangelize. They didn't face the issue. They didn't carry out any kind of proper purge of the liberals in their groupings. They wouldn't fight. They wouldn't oppose them. So you had the age of evangelistic crusades suddenly opened up. We're good people. We're loyal to the Bible. We're 100% evangelical. They were like the Israelites rushing up the hill of the Amorites. We'll go. We'll fight. Yes, but they weren't commissioned. And neither were evangelicals who would not exercise discipline and oppose wrong teaching and face up to their problems, neither did they, therefore, have any warrant of God to make things look good by launching themselves into evangelism. And you know, the great spate of evangelism at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, came to nothing. Crusades everywhere. Things continued to go down apace. God wasn't with them. The denominations continued to deteriorate. Spurgeon seceded in 1887, and many Baptists followed him. A steady trickle out of the increasingly compromised denominations into the 20th century. And those denominations now are dominated by liberalism. The historic denominations. There's just an example. Here it is. Verse 42, say unto them, go not up. But they went, and they were routed by the Amorites. very interesting that in the book of Numbers we read Moses didn't even set foot out of the camp to accompany them. He wasn't allowed into the promised land, but you'd think he'd have gone with them to the border if there was any blessing on their military crusade. He wouldn't stir out of the camp. Nor did the priests go with them. The Ark of God was not taken. Nothing went with them. They had no warrant to do what they were doing. God had now withdrawn from them. And so, verse 46, ye abode in Kadesh. I'd like to say more, but oh friends, you don't want quiet lives, spiritually quiet, no instrumentality. You don't want quiet churches, no real blessing, ever diminishing. Trust the Lord. They had 38 silent years, fruitless years. Remember the blessings of God. Remember all the evidences. Trust him, consecrate yourselves to him, wholly and entirely, be his people, his servants, 100%. That's the message of the first chapter of Deuteronomy, the first part of the first sermon of Moses, the man of God. Let's sing together the hymn 474. Hymn 474. In full and glad surrender.